all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Chris Edmonds. Chris, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you today.
Well, we're going to get to talk about your father.
Yeah, Roderick, and his nickname, I guess, or part of his name was Roddy. We called him, of course, I called him Dad, but most everybody called him Roddy.
Well, Roddy Edmonds had a very important career in the military in World War II, and we want to talk a little bit about that because you went on a journey to find out sort of what Dad did in World War II, prompted by your daughters. And I should say that Chris Edmonds is a pastor and grew up in eastern Tennessee, as did his father. But Chris, let's start with where Roddy, sort of how he got into the military and how he found himself preparing for in the middle of World War II.
Yes, sir. He grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee, and really that's a city in East Tennessee, just near the Smoky Mountains. He loved the Smoky Mountains. But he grew up what I would consider relatively poor. His father was a professional paper hanger, but at age three, his mom passed away in really trying to have another little baby. And dad basically grew up from the age of three without a mom. And then he, at the age of 10, the depression hit. And so I say dad to most folks, I'll just say dad didn't have much stuff growing up, but he had the right stuff because his family, had a strong faith in God and they tried to live right. They lived in a neighborhood that is kind of typical of the neighborhoods that people grew up in the Depression. Everybody took care of each other. So there were lots of moms and dads looking out for all the kids, which was good. But he learned the value of doing what's right. And I even had, as I began this journey, trying to discover what really happened to Dad, not only in World War II, but I discovered so much about my family and his boyhood years. My wife's great aunt happened to grow up with Dad. I didn't even know that till I began this journey. And she said Dad was in the neighborhood was kind of a steady presence. I said particularly loved playing with younger kids and kind of being around and helping them. And then he would also kind of take care of any bullies that showed up. So he kind of had this real sense of doing what's right for others. He was in safety patrol as a kid, and that turned into, I think, a desire to be a servant and a leader as well. When he went to high school, he attended Knoxville High School, which was one of the two large high schools in the Knoxville city at the time, and they had a large and very successful junior ROTC program. I didn't know he was a part of junior ROTC until, again, started this journey and started digging into his past. And he joined the junior ROTC that is some of his brothers had been in, his older brothers, as soon as he got there as a freshman and continued it all the way through to his senior year. It was a unique program because they had a firing range on top of this. On the top floor of the school. And so he learned to shoot a rifle. I'm assuming, if not before, he definitely learned to hone his skills with the rifle in high school. But, you know, in that time, that day and time, the war was all around and was pushing its way towards the United States. And it was inevitable that the U.S. would be involved. And Dad graduated in 1938. And in 1940, President Roosevelt came to Knoxville, kept passed through Knoxville on his way to dedicate the Smoky Mountains. And Dad was in the crowd, and I'm sure he had a deep respect for the president, and he had great love for his country. I know that his whole life he loved the United States of America and he loved his family. So I think he felt compelled to go serve as we got drawn into closer to the war. But he actually joined the Army in March of 1941, before Pearl Harbor. And so all of his men that he served with and who he led, even as a master sergeant later in a couple, 2 or 3 years down the road when he was training men, they all thought he was much older than them because he was part of what they called the regular Army. You know, he didn't join up after the tragedy of Pearl Harbor. So I think his sense of duty to his fellow man, I think his love for his country, and obviously his love for his family, and doing what's right. And he had a real sense of standing up to evil. I think all of those led to him joining the Army.
Well, it's more than just joining the Army. It's actually how he ended up performing his duties, which we'll get to here. But that's why his formative years are so important, to understand his facing down evil when he was a prisoner of war of the Nazis. But what happens, let's get us to that point. What happens with Rhodey is that he finds himself at the Battle of the Bulge in the Battle of the Hürtgen Forest, which you and your co-author Douglas Century do a fabulous job of painting the battle picture that's going on and the thicket of this forest that they're fighting in. It's really great history, Chris, that you've put into the book, No Surrender, A Father, A Son, and an Extraordinary Act of Heroism that continues to live on to today. But that battle ultimately results in his capture. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, as we head to that, I do want one other foundational piece to his ultimately standing up to the Nazis is his faith. As a middle school young man, he placed his faith in God and became, you know, a follower of Christ, and that was foundational from that day forward. That transformed his mind and his heart towards humanity, and he absolutely believed that there was a God and that God was good, and that, you know, that was a settled truth in his mind and his heart. And because of that, he had the responsibility to love others, regardless of who they were, and he did that his whole life. And I think in the context of war, that came into play. And so when he trained hundreds of men to be ready to fight. And he did that at Fort Jackson. He actually, when he joined the Army and plunged into becoming a military man, it happened at Fort Jackson. And most of his training there for himself and many others happened there. But then eventually went to Camp Atterbury. While he was at Camp Atterbury, that's where he was. He was a master sergeant there. And the 106 was formed just prior to them coming to Camp Atterbury, trained hundreds and hundreds of men. And the last group of men that he trained were the youngest and the greenest men that he ever trained. And they were sent very quickly toward the end of 1944. Basically, October 44, they were sent to the European theater. And after traveling through England and landing in Scotland, traveling through England and continuing on through France, they ended up on the front lines at Belgium to replace 106th Infantry, replaced the second division there on the front lines. And so they settled in what was considered to be a picnic. It's even in Dad's diary, you know, it was supposed to be a picnic, a piece of cake, so to speak. A good place to train young green recruits you know, to have them on the front lines there. Nothing was going on, very quiet sector. They've got there, got all set up on December 10th and started settling in, and then the war came to them. And that was the launching of the Battle of the Bulge by the Nazis, and Hitler's plan to march to Antwerp in a Blitzkrieg style was impeded when he ran into men like Dad and others who served with him. These green men who had had no experience in warfare, real warfare, were trained well. And they responded well. They responded to the overwhelming odds of armament and troops, and delayed them time and time again, to the point that the Germans did not fulfill their mission. And in the midst of that, Dad's men, the 422nd for sure, many of the 423rd, some of the 424th regiments were completely surrounded. They fought valiantly for 3 days and eventually were captured. All of those men are more than heroes who served there. Now, some of those men had served in the Hurtgen Force as well. Particularly the one, Paul Stern, one of the men there, he served as a medic in the 28th Division, and they fought all the way through. They helped liberate Paris, came all the way through and fought in the Hurtgen Force, and Paul told me, he said, my first minutes on the battlefield, he said, I was changed forever. I was a change. He said, I was a boy, and I became a man very quickly, and I was changed forever.
Chris, you knew that your father had been a POW, but as you did this research and found out what he and his men went through getting to the POW camp, getting to Stalag 9A, tell us what surprised or shocked or jolted you as you did your research to find out what they actually were going through.
Yeah. Dad never talked about it. You know, I knew that he was a POW because I played Army in my neighborhood in his Army shirt, you know. I mean, and I carried a stick around, you know, just pretending to be an Army guy. But he never talked about it. And then when I got older as a college kid, I asked him specifically to tell me about it. He said, son, there's some things I'd rather not talk about. And so he never did. He only shared one word. He said, son, I'll tell you one thing. We were humiliated. He said, the Germans humiliated us. And that was their goal, obviously. So basically my journey began with my daughter who was in college. My twin daughters are in college. They were taking a history class. One of my daughter's group's project became my father and his experience as a POW. And then he had written two personal diaries. And some of it was narrative about the battle. Some of it was narrative about their POW experience. But a lot of it was more reflection upon war and its experience. And he didn't tell a whole lot of what happened specifically. There were some cryptic kind of notes that he had made in it. But so my journey really began when my daughter started that project. And I began rereading his old diary. Dad had been dead at that point for 20 years at that point. And so he took everything that he experienced in World War II and in Korea later when he was called up for Korea, took that all to his grave. So looking at that diary and rereading it and watching my daughter's video that they made as a group just sparked me. And I said, I got to find out what happened because it seemed like more happened there than we know. And so like most World War II vets and probably most veterans who have been in combat, he never talked about his service. But in his diary, he wrote things like this. A lot of things I'm not going to write because they aren't exactly nice to talk about. But then he wrote, I know God was with us and he answered our prayers. Well, there again, his faith was dominant even in the worst conditions. And then he wrote this insightful observation. I learned men even better than before. Some were good, some were bad, some were better, some were worse. At the end of his diary, he writes, "I'm just writing this so I don't have to talk about it. Anybody wants to read it, that's fine." But, you know, he never pulled it out. He never showed that diary to anybody. He never brought it up. It was just a hidden experience in his life. So I began rereading that diary and digging into it. And here's what I found. I found out that in his POW experience, after he went to the first camp, he and all the non-commissioned officers were transferred to a second camp. In that first camp, Jewish men were segregated. Jewish American GIs, POWs, were segregated for the purposes of sending them to death camps. A lot of people don't know that. And so Dad saw his friends, particularly Lester Tanner, Tannenbaum at the time, be sent off to this prison within a prison in that first camp. Well, the second camp, all the non-coms are transferred into Ziegenhain, Stalag 9A. Along with Lester and all of Dad's Jewish buddies who were non-com officers were sent along with Dad. Well, Dad was the highest ranking American soldier in that camp, Stalag 9A, and it was near Ziegenhain, Germany. It was near the end of the war, like January 45, and so the Nazis, even there, their strict anti-Jew policies were in place, and their plans were to segregate the Jewish POWs from non-Jews and send them to certain death. Particularly, they were going to send them to Berga. So Lester even told me, he said, they were told as Jewish soldiers, American Jewish soldiers, by the army, that if they ever fell into enemy hands, they should probably destroy their dog tags and not mention their Jewish identity.
Let me interrupt because one of the things that
go ahead.
I don't want you to gloss over is you were able to track back some of the men that served with your father in the POW camp, some of the Jewish American soldiers, and get firsthand accounts from them about the act of bravery that your father did in defiance to the Nazi orders. So tell us about that initial act of defiance on behalf of the Jewish American soldiers.
I will. Let me just say that meeting all these men has been the highest privilege of my life. And it's been a miracle of God that I even connected with these men, and they told their story, through Dad's story. But so it was late the evening, January 26th, the German officers sent orders to my father and announced over the loudspeaker to the American forces that only the Jewish soldiers were to report outside for the next morning's roll call. Anyone who disobeyed that order would be shot. That was their order. So very orders, very clear, very specific. And so without hesitation, according to testimony, Dad turned to the men in his barracks and said, "We're not doing that. Tomorrow we all fall out." And he sent orders to the other four barracks of American soldiers and ordered them to fall out just as usual. And that's what they did. It was bitterly cold that morning. As everyone knows, that winter was one of the worst winters on record in Germany. It was January 27th, 1945. And so as the Nazi commander approached, he couldn't believe his eyes. And this commander was not the commandant of the camp. This was a man from high command. But he couldn't believe his eyes because standing before him were all the Americans, and he knew that immediately. There were nearly 1,300 soldiers lined up in sharp formation, and some of these men had to be helped to get out there because they were already 40 days into starvation at this point. And so the German major, Major Siegmann, stormed over to my father, and he got up in his face. He angrily said, "They cannot all be Jews," to which my father declared, "We are all Jews here." And the Nazi turned blood red. He could not believe this little American sergeant was disobeying his orders. No one had ever done that to him. And so he lunges forward, he presses. Go ahead.
And I want to stop and have Veteran Radio listeners reflect on what Chris Edmonds is telling us about his father's act here. Not only his own internal fortitude to resist, but the other roughly 1,300 men who came out at his direction to save, or hopefully save, about 200 Jewish American soldiers who were in the camp. Just think about what that took for all of those men. Your father's out front, he's got the Luger pressed against his forehead, but all of those men have to be worried about, am I going to be mowed down next?
Yeah. Well, I'm quick to say, point out that, you know, all these men are more than heroes, not just Dad. Obviously, Dad's leadership helped get to this moment of confrontation and resisting, you know, and defying the Nazi orders. But all those men were heroes, because any one of those men could have refused to even come out. They could have just said, I'm not going out there. That's not the order that the Germans would give us. I'm staying in my barracks. But they all came out. Then when the gun was produced, the threat occurred. Any one of those men could have started pointing out their Jewish fellow soldiers. None of them did.
And I want to elevate or expedite this a little bit, because we're going to run out of time, and I don't want to miss two more important facts, and that is, as the war comes to a close and the camp can tell that the American and Allied forces are advancing, the prospect of marching these, at this point, emaciated soldiers deeper in to safer territory comes about. And the second act of defiance that your father pulls off, knowing full well, hey, I pressed my luck once and I got away with it. Can I do it again? Yeah. Tell us about this second act.
Yeah. Well, obviously, Dad's willful defiance of the major, Major Siegmund, turns into victory for the Americans, because Dad refuses to turn over the Jewish men. He actually told the major, he said, Major, you can shoot me, but you'll have to kill all of us, because we know who you are, and you'll stand for war crimes when we win this war. And then he said, and you will pay. At that moment, the major made a choice. He decided not to shoot Dad, and he put his gun back in his holster. He turned and walked out of, back to his quarters, and then left the camp and never asked for the Jewish men again. So fast forward two more months later, the Americans are very close by, getting ready to come and liberate the camp. And the Germans give another similar order, and they said, tomorrow morning, everyone's going to fall out and be ready to leave the camp. We're going to march everybody out. So that again tells his men, we're not doing that. We're going to refuse to go. We're going to defy their orders. And he hatched a plan. And the plan was basically for the healthy guys to take care of the sick guys, take them back to the barracks, and just keep doing that. Fall out, then take them back to the barracks. Fall out, take them back to the barracks. Do that all day long. While they were doing that, and so they started working the plan that morning. They marched the Russian quadrant out, the British quadrant, and the French quadrant were all marched out. The Americans refused to go.
And fundamental in that is his recognition and the other men's recognition that many of them are so starved, these men won't survive a march.
No, they won't. They won't. And Dad said that to his leaders. He said, we're too weak to go on this march. We don't know what's out there. Our best hope, our best chance is to stay in the camp. And said, you know, The Germans are wanting to get out of it, you know, bad. So we're staying, and whatever happens, happens. So they just made a choice. We're gonna die, or we're gonna live in this camp. That this is our stand. Much like they'd made earlier with protecting the Jewish men. So at the end of the day, toward dusk, the commandant of the camp came out. And it's Dad's. I found this in Dad's handwriting about a year and a half ago. My mom had scrolled it away. There's three pages of three happenings that happened in the camp, and this was one of them he was telling. And in his own words, he said, the old German colonel came up to him, threw up his hands, and says, okay, you win. We're leaving. You can have the camp. And the Germans marched out and left the Americans alone. And Lester said it. He said it's the greatest escape in World War II, but we didn't go anywhere. We stayed in the camp.
And again, the odds of surviving in the winter in a forced march when they're so emaciated was, you know, the odds were small to survive. And that's why this story of Rhody Edmonds in No Surrender, it's put out or published by HarperCollins, Harper One, an imprint of HarperCollins publisher, is really worth reading. You're going to learn about not only his story, but the men who followed him. You're going to learn in reading this, Chris, I found really interesting the whole story of the Army Specialized Training Program that unfortunately we don't have a lot of time to talk about. I want to finish. I want to finish with one thing. Your father was named as Righteous Among the Nations by Yad Vashem in Israel, Israel's National Holocaust Memorial. He is one of five Americans. He's the only serviceman to have ever been so named. Correct. This high honor is incredible. Tell us just a little bit about what that meant to the family.
For us as a family, it was a surprise. We had no idea that they even had Dad's name and information. They spent over a year interviewing several of the key POWs who were a part of that experience and doing historical background search on that as well and verifying. And then when they announced in 2015, they actually I got a phone call on June 6th of 2015, which was D-Day of 2015, about the award and the honor. It is one of the, to us, it is a great, if not the greatest honor he will receive. I mean, to be honored along those of like Schindler and Sugihara and others who have, Sir Winton, who put their life on the line for Jewish brothers and sisters who were being murdered, brutally murdered and massacred by the Nazis. It's an incredible honor, particularly with Dad's faith. Dad's faith as a Christian.
Exactly. It goes back to that early training we were talking about, that early upbringing, his moral center that he developed in that small rural town of eastern Tennessee carried him through his short life, but through some incredibly heroic events. And for him to be honored for saying, you know, standing up to the Nazis and saying, we are all Jews and saving everyone because of that, is really a great story. And I encourage people to go out and buy No Surrender by Chris Edmonds and Douglas Suntree.
It's fantastic, and it's touching lives across the world. Even President Obama at the Rising Ceremony, you know, to have a President of the United States visit and speak at your father's ceremony was beyond, you know, our comprehension. And he basically said, you know, your father's moral compass never wavered. He said, you know, he looked the Nazi in the eyes and dared a Nazi to shoot. And he said, I don't know of a better expression of Christianity than to lay down your life for your friends. And he did what was right. Dad's moral compass right was right, even if everybody said it was wrong.
Exactly. Chris, tell us where, if people are interested in finding more about you or your dad or the work that you're doing in his name, how do they keep up to date on what's going on?
Yeah. NoSurrenderBook.com has all the information about the book. There's tons of pictures on there. There's book trailers. There's some really good information on there about the book and about the lives involved in the book. And then RoddyEdmonds.com. It's just RoddyEdmonds.com. And that's our website as well. You know, I'm doing a lot of speaking. If they're interested in having me come and talk talk about the book, talk about Dad's story, and the men. It really, Dad, this notebook, No Surrender, is about Dad, but it's about the other heroes who served with him. You know, Staff Sergeant Frankie Serenzi of the 106th Infantry, Staff Sergeant Lester Tan of the 106th, 422nd, Corporal Paul Stern of the 28th Division, Sonny Fox, Sergeant Irwin Sonny Fox, but Irwin Fox of New York as well, and so many like them. You know, Hank Friedman, who lives down in Georgia, still alive and still full of patriotism and love for our country. And I mean, if his body would let him, he could still handle a rifle and still go fight for us. I mean, he's that spirited, and just men across the country. To me, it speaks to our need as a nation now. It's a book that you will cry when you read it. You will laugh. You will stand up and cheer, and you will believe, surely you will believe, we live in the greatest country on the planet, and it's because of our freedoms and because they've been secured by the men and women of our armed forces. And for that, we need to love them well and take care of them well.
Chris, if you
and
have
so a... that's one of my missions as well, is just to love our veterans and our veterans in the past, our veterans now, all who are serving.
Chris, if you have a few more minutes, I would like to ask you about the Jewish men that you were able to go talk to who served with your father. And I also want to talk to you about how a number of them came out of the Army Specialized Training Program. So why don't we start there? Why don't we start with the Army Specialized Training Program? Because honestly, I've never really read about this before, the Quiz Kids. And some of those kids, if you will, ended up serving with your father and living through this experience. So tell us about ASTP.
Yeah, ASTP was an Army Specialized Training Program, and it was they took the brightest and the best of the Army, and they did tests, you know, to determine who those people were, and they were attending college. They had colleges across the country where they would send these soldiers. Now, the soldiers still, you know, did their normal Army service, you know, get up and do their calisthenics. And you know, they were in the regimen of the Army program, but they would also go and study alongside other students who weren't in the Army, particular subjects. And these men were going to be slotted for officer material. They would come out of this program and be officers. Well, in the midst of this program, after D-Day, there was such a need for infantrymen that they took the brightest and the best that the Army had to offer, these young men who were just, I mean, incredible. They call them quiz kids, you know, because they were so bright. And they slugged them back into the infantry. And then Dad received a bunch of these men as new recruits for him to train in and to hone into being fighting soldiers before they went over to the European theater.
Well, this was sort of an interesting idea by the Army to identify and train the best and the brightest. Give us some names of people who fit that caption that we might recognize.
Well, Carl Reiner was one. Mel Brooks was one. His name slips my mind. He was he's former Secretary of State.
I have the list in front of me. Includes Bob Dole, Kurt Vonnegut, Gore Vidal.
Bob Dole, Kurt Vonnegut, Henry Kissinger, and then the men who were with Dad, Paul Stern, Sidney Skip Friedman, Lester Tanner. Now, see, Lester and Skip are perfect examples. Both ended up after they survived this horrendous and horrible situation in POW camps. They came back to the States and finished their law degree. Lester graduated from Harvard in '48, and he's been an incredible attorney in the New York area for years. He even had a landmark case. Back in the think it was in the 80s, on discrimination. He settled a landmark case. And Mr. Friedman, Skip Friedman, they call him Skipopedia because he's so bright, he could remember anything. A great historian, but he had a very successful career as an attorney. Both of these men worked, well, Skip passed away a couple of years ago, but he worked right up until the time, he passed away. He was semi-retired. And Lester is 90, he'll be 96 this year, and he's still working in New York. Though he's semi-retired, he's still got a few key clients.
Well, you wrote, and you wrote on this ASTP, and I want to quote this because I think this is where it just sort of the light bulb went off for me. You wrote, "The ASTP would leave a profound footprint on U.S. history and culture of the 20th century. It has been called a groundbreaking social experiment in merit-based advancement, one that helped to more fully democratize American society by selecting its trainees based on their inherent ability rather than on their family social economic status," end of quote. And that's what's so interesting. Yeah. Some of the men you're talking about came out of, you know, humble backgrounds or maybe poor socioeconomic or ethnic Jewish backgrounds where they certainly didn't have a leg up in life. But the Army came around and said, "Hey, you guys are really bright. We've got a place for you." Now, none of them thought that the place was on the frontline infantry, but it's a real interesting program, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. And none of these guys did expect to be on the front lines in the infantry, okay? They expected to be in leadership positions. And these guys were leaders, but even though many of them came from very humble backgrounds, obviously, most all of them lived through the fires and of the Depression, you know, but that's where they were forged with a steel-like survivability. I mean, they knew how to survive because they came through the fires of the Depression. And they were so bright and they were also cheerful. I mean, they loved life. That was the same way. They loved life to their dying breath. And so everything was an adventure to them. And some of them actually turned down really great possibilities. Like Lester, he was promoted through his high school years quicker than normal. And graduated, you know, when he just a young guy, I think he was 16 when he graduated. And then he went on to City College and was headed to become a doctor and then decided because the war broke out, he needed to go help. He needed to serve. So he sped up his college degree, changed it from being a doctor to just getting kind of an undergrad degree. And then he actually sped it up. Took extra classes so he could get out and join the service and be a part of the service. Skip is similar. Skip was a great football player in Cleveland. He and his brother, Maury, both were star players in Cleveland, Ohio. And Maury was a year older. And when Maury graduated, he was offered a scholarship to the University of Alabama to play football. And then Skip was offered a scholarship to DePaul University to play football. And both decided that service to their country was the priority. And both joined the military, joined the Army, and were part of that ASTP program.
Well, and the other thing that you have to think about, it, and your dad would have experienced this, which is you had these kids in the ASTP program, some of the brightest, and all of a sudden they're just plopped into an infantry group and said, drill and train. They could have really had a bad attitude. And you can think a little bit about how today's millennials and others, Gen Zs, might have handled this transformation from higher status to they might look at it as lower status. But your dad had to work with these guys and was very successful in integrating them into the unit, wasn't he?
He was, and part of that was Dad's love for his men. Lester said they knew that Dad loved them and cared about them because he was he would always do what was expected of them. He never asked them to do anything that he wasn't willing to do. If it was a long march, he was with them. If it was living out in the elements, he was with them. He was showing them how to do it. And then, you know, aside from the rigor of their training and their duty, the Army duties, he was just a good guy, and they recognized that. Now, Lester said he was tough, said he was tough as nails on us, but he said he was fair. And he expected us to be great soldiers. And so he said Dad loved all the men in the same way. Matter of fact, Dad indicates in some of his writings that he was grateful for his boys. He was grateful for not only their bravery and their courage, but also their smarts. I mean, you think about taking the combination of intelligence and courage and mixing that together and putting that into the infantry. That makes a huge difference. Because when leaders are unfortunately killed in battle, other leaders who are there, young guys, step up who have that innate leadership ability and they have the courage to do it. They step up.
Well, I want to thank you, Chris Edmonds, for spending some time with Veterans Radio today to talk about your father, Rody Edmonds, his infectious love for God, his Christianity, his belief, his love of other people, and the extraordinary acts that he performed as a prisoner of war to live out that Christian belief. And again, we would encourage people to pick up the book, No Surrender, by HarperCollins, and to go to nosurrenderbook.com?
Nosurrenderbook.com, yes. And let me just say two quick things, and I'll be done. I believe an ordinary life lived well is extraordinary, even heroic. That was Dad's life. And we're speaking to hundreds of thousands of listeners, I pray, who are just ordinary people. And so go live your life, do what's right for others, and be the hero. The second thing I would say is I believe Dad is worthy of honors in the United States, just as he was in Israel. And so there's a gold medal bill in the House and the Senate. I'm praying that will get passed sometime down the road. I would even hope that he would be considered for a Medal of Honor sometime in the future. But I think our nation needs to honor our heroes, and we do a good job of that. But I think this is one unsung hero who hasn't been honored, and I would like to see that happen. If just for nothing else is to encourage the young people in our nation to do what's right.
I couldn't agree with that more. Chris Edmonds, thanks for taking some time with Veterans Radio today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a joy.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.